If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, June the 13th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Michael Auslin. He is the Hoover Institution's inaugural Williams Griffiths Fellow in Contemporary Asia, specializing in global risk analysis, U.S. security and foreign policy strategy, and security and political relations in Asia. That would include, of course, North Korea, and for the purposes of this podcast, Singapore, the scene of this week's historic summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, the first such one-on-one between a U.S. president and a North Korean leader. Actually, let me correct that, a North Korean supreme leader. I believe that's the title that he goes by. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill, for having me.
Actually, welcome back to the show.
Yes.
Yes. All right, so 1940, the movie The Road to Singapore, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Dorothy L'Amour. Two defining features of Hope Crosby movies, Michael. Number one, Hope is always making fun of Bing Crosby's weight line, so there's always a fat joke in there. Second defining feature, Hope and Crosby are always playing con men or grifters. Make of that what you will of Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, but let's talk about the 2018 Road to Singapore. Three questions, Michael, and take it away. Number one, are you surprised that this actually went down? Second, are you surprised by what transpired? And then thirdly, other than FaceTime, the significance of these two gentlemen meeting?
Well, Bill, I think everyone was surprised that this fell together so quickly. And don't forget, it was not an initiative of the United States. This came from the South Koreans. And this was something where while all North Korean leaders had wanted a meeting with the U.S. president, U.S. presidents were rightfully very wary of committing to a meeting, which would give legitimacy to the North Korean leaders, without having some, you know, material changes in the relationship between the two countries. We didn't get those material changes. The material change we got is that Kim Jong-un, I would probably call him a bold opportunist, someone who is unafraid to go out onto the world stage in a way that I think his father and grandfather were a little more hesitant, decided to roll the dice and see if he could get Trump to the table. Now, a lot of this was brokered by the South Koreans. It was pushed by the South Koreans. And I think in a different administration, this would not have happened. And it wouldn't have happened at least yet. Instead, they would have gone probably back to the traditional model of, you know, working slowly from the ground up with a whole bunch of meetings at various levels until you inched your way up to the summit, literally the apex, which is the two leaders meeting. But Donald Trump does things differently. I mean, he thinks that that path is probably the path that gave us a nuclear North Korea. It doesn't solve anything. So he accepted Kim Jong-un's gamble, his bet. He saw it. He doubled down and agreed to meet him. So I think it was the speed that surprised many of us, not that ultimately you would get a meeting. The question of what was your second question?
Second question is: Are you surprised by actually what transpired?
It was
a pretty brief summit by summit standards.
Well, for leader summits, it's sort of pretty normal. I mean, if you think we didn't, you know, it wasn't like Reagan and Gorbachev spent weekends together. They would meet for a few hours. I think so. What I was more surprised at was two things: one, the amity between them, or apparent amity between them, and second, I'll come back to that. Let me start with the amity. What I would have expected was a much more antiseptic meeting. Right. I think it would have been something where, you know, we would glare at each other a little bit across the table, and you know, the first meeting, and try to stake out positions. But these guys look like this was their 12th meeting. They look like they play pinochle together every weekend. I mean, they were comfortable. They were patting each other on the back. They took the stroll. Trump showed him the car. You know, it was much more personal and personable than I actually expected. I would have thought that both sides would have been, you know, it's a little bit, I mean, look, these leaders have not ever met, you know, since the 1940s and the creation of North Korea. It's a little bit like that opening scene in Battlestar Galactica where the Earth representative's always waiting for the Cylon to show up, and they never do, and then they suddenly do, and what do you do when they're there? But But this was as if these guys had spent tons of time together. So so that surprised me. From Trump's perspective, by the way, given the age difference, it's probably hard not to feel paternalistic, even though this is a bloodthirsty, ruthless dictator who's assassinated dozens of people at a minimum and runs torture camps and the like. But, you know, you saw that almost paternalistic approach. When these types of summits happen, both sides are very careful to make sure that leaders get equal speaking time, right? You don't want one to seem dominant over the other. And even though we had the flags right next to each other, which has riled some people, and I probably would have preferred that we had two sets of flags separated on either side versus the interwoven flags. Right. If you notice, Trump spoke much more than Kim did. In fact, he encouraged him to speak, said, do you want to, you know, when they were at the table doing the signing, he said, do you want to speak? Right. So Trump came across both as somewhat paternalistic, not in a negative sense, as the older figure, but also the one who sort of drove the meeting. And I think part of that is probably due to the fact that, you know, other than meeting Xi Jinping and Moon, Kim has not been on the world stage. Right. So that leads me to the second point that I had. I said two things surprised me. One was the amity. Mm-hmm. The second one was the confidence that both of them had. The stakes were high.
Right.
I think that no matter what happened, Kim Jong-un would have come out a winner, but, you know, the stakes were very high on him. If you watched the live video feeds, I mean, the North Koreans were on their best behavior. These were not scowling, mean-looking guys that, run death camps and torture and in the past have starved their own people. These are guys that you're thinking, man, I'd hang out with them. They all looked ingratiating and happy to be there, and sort of there was that weird, I'd like to get a readout on it, there was that weird moment after the stroll and Trump showed Kim the car where Trump, Kim, Bolton, and the North Koreans and some of the Americans were just standing around in front of the rooms,
right,
sort of talking, like trying to figure out what to do. Now that, on the one hand, may have been a function of the rushed nature of this. They didn't have everything nailed down the way you usually do,
right.
But it looked like he was talking with allies, or quite honestly, better than allies, given how the G7 went. I mean, they were all sitting there talking, should we do this, should we do that? And mm-hmm. You could see Kim earnestly listening. I mean, it was fascinating political theater because these things are usually so incredibly scripted. But beyond that, both looked very confident. Kim did not look cowed. He did not look... he looked a little nervous. I think part of it is sweltering heat, and they were probably both exhausted. But... it was his first time way away from the country. He's only been out of the country once or twice.
I'd like you to build on that. Didn't Kim go to school in Switzerland?
Yeah, he did. I'm sorry. Out of the country as a leader and for years.
That said, Michael, he's 34 years old. He's a very young man. Donald Trump celebrates a birthday this week. I believe he's 72, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think so.
So he is more than double Kim's age. So here's a 34-year-old man who has spent time in Switzerland. But otherwise, the extent that he travels, he's speaking to fellow communist. So now he has plopped himself down in the center of an incredible crown jewel of capitalism, which is Singapore. Just like going to Hong Kong, this just spectacular, city structure, just this city of riches. So you wonder just how comfortable he is being surrounded by the capitalism, being in a strange setting, knowing the pressure of this, but yet I'm not lauding the man, if the man has a lot of problems, obviously, but to see how a 34-year-old man would react in this situation, I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, Bill, you raise a good point. In fact, he did a walkabout, which
right.
Trump did not do.
Right.
We're still absorbing everything that happened, and we're absorbing the images. And one of the most fascinating, maybe stunning, was was Kim doing a nighttime walkabout. And obviously, this was there probably wasn't a living soul within 5 miles of the walkabout, but he was still doing it.
Right.
And that was something, again, you never saw. I mean, it brought your mind back to Gorbachev and Glasnost, and we have to be very careful. Very careful not to overinterpret what happened or to create expectations that will be dashed. You remember when he first came to office, or not office, power, back in 2012, his father died. I think it was the end of 2011. And of course, he liked basketball and he had Dennis Rodman. So everyone was talking, and he liked Mickey Mouse. Everyone was talking about a Pyongyang spring, right? And of course, we didn't have that unless it's a very, very slow thaw. So let's not overinterpret it. But it was fascinating, to your point, to see him walking around Singapore and equally fascinating, maybe even more so, is that the entire front page of the North Korean propaganda government paper was splashed. They had about 15 pictures on the front page, just like you're looking at a photo stream, of pictures of him walking around. Now, that sends signals. The North Koreans are seeing those buildings behind him. They're seeing him, you're right, walk, essentially breathe the air for a few hours at least of a capitalist state,
right,
not stay hermetically sealed. And we don't know how that's going to play out. And of course, he has talked about, and this is important too to remember, now that their nuclear and ballistic missile program has succeeded, in his view, he has talked about turning back to the economy, to I wouldn't say reform the economy, but to strengthen the economy.
Right. So that ties into the final question, Michael, which is the significance of this meeting. Besides, obviously, the novelty of these two shaking hands, the novelty of seeing Kim Jong-un strolling through downtown Singapore, the novelty of Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un acting as peacemakers and statesmen on the world stage, what really is the significance of this meeting? Because there are people who want to put very little into this, and there are people who want to put a lot into it.
Well, I don't think, as always, I'm a proponent of the golden mean. I mean, you know, if you discount this at all, I think you're missing, you know, the fact that this is the first time we've had the two leaders sit down. And of course, right, if you say this is the beginning of a new era of peace, you are, you know, you're pulling a Neville Chamberlain. So you've got to sort of come down in the middle. So let's go through what was the significance of the outcomes in terms of the signed statement. Mm-hmm. There was nothing new in that statement, and in fact, it referenced the statement, of course, that Kim had signed with Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, a few months ago. However, what was new is that for the first time you had the signatures of two leaders on the statement. Mm-hmm. We've never had that before.
Right.
So you've brought it up to the ultimate level, the ultimate sanction of the supreme leader, or whatever his formal title is, and the president of the United States committing themselves to this process, which means that if the North Koreans revert to form and break it or cheat or do something,
right,
it's tied to Kim. There's no longer a position for someone to say, well, you know, these guys, we didn't get the top guy, so maybe someone else did the cheating. No, it's Kim.
Right.
And the same thing with Trump, you know, the commitment. That said, however, there are also some significant things that are of concern, or more concern, potential concern. First is the formulation that was used in the statement, complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
That means North and South, right?
That includes the South, which would include the U.S. security guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if you solve the North Korean nuclear threat, then you don't need a U.S. nuclear guarantee, but to say that, you know, this is what's on the table, you know, opens up clearly the idea that the U.S. security guarantee is also to be negotiated.
Right.
But it also dropped two terms that the U.S. has insisted on for years, verifiable and irreversible. Now, common sense leads you to think that, well, of course, it has to be verified. And you know, one of Ronald Reagan's greatest lines, we will use it forever, is trust but verify. And he's
right,
absolutely right. So dropping the verifiable, which opens questions of how do you then negotiate with North Korea? If it has not said, we agree to verifiable denuclearization, now you have to now get that into the negotiating, which means are they going to allow IAEA inspectors, third-party inspectors, U.S., who knows? So it would have been better to have verifiable in there. And irreversible. I mean, you know, that's sort of, again, common sense. If, you know, we get them to denuclearize, we don't want them to go back. But that also includes, you know, issues of, for example, destroying, or at least potentially destroying, laboratories, research laboratories, factories, all those types of things, so that they can't be repurposed, which means they can be re-repurposed back to the original purpose, which mm-hmm. would be nukes. So,
right,
so that's of concern to the folks who follow this carefully. The other thing, of course. Two of them. One is that Trump, this was not in the document, but in his statements afterwards, said that we are in some way stopping or cutting back on the military exercises we do with South Korea. And he used language that the North Koreans have used, that these are provocative. And he also used his own language, that these are expensive.
Right.
This is something that North Korea and China have wanted for a very long time. China immediately welcomed it. So it's concerning. And you see today there's this sort of backfilling and people scrambling to say, well, we're still going to train, but we won't do certain types of exercises. this is the type of thing that at summits need to be nailed down before you make the statement so that there's no ambiguity, because you don't want to be seen yet as driving a wedge between the North Korean, between the South Koreans and the U.S. The second thing, of course, that Trump said in his comments that's of concern is that at some point he wants to bring U.S. troops home. Now, obviously, the end point is bringing U.S. troops home, but we can only do that when North Korea is no longer a threat, when it's denuclearized, when you have probably reconciliation on the peninsula, if not reunification. And then, of course, you want to bring the troops home. And he said it's not on the table, but he did bring it into the room. And right. So the question is the leverage points by even bringing it up where North Korea, and quite frankly, even South Korea, given the current government, could be pressing that, you know, this is part of the bargain. Right. You know, you agree to get those troops off during this process, which is, we should not do that. We should agree that the troops will come home when this whole thing is solved. You don't say, we'll bring the troops home as you're denuclearizing. That's a recipe for disaster. Right. We do it when the whole thing's settled. So those two things that Trump mentioned are things that people will be trying to figure out on this end. How do you deal with them during negotiations?
So Winston Churchill in 1942 famously says, this is not the end, it is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. Is it an overstatement to say that this summit perhaps marks the end of the beginning of a military solution to North Korea, Michael, or is a military option still on the table if the North Koreans turn out to be bad faith actors?
Oh, for sure. I mean, look, if the North Koreans tomorrow decide to attack Seoul, we will help defend our ally.
Right.
If they attack Japan, we'll help defend our ally. Mm-hmm. You know, the question of, is this even the end of the beginning? I don't think so. We're not at the beginning of the beginning, because we've obviously been negotiating with the North Koreans for 25 years. Mm-hmm. I think we're in the middle of the beginning. And I think to get to the end of the beginning, you have to see that there is real and fundamental change that is occurring that gives you confidence. Mm-hmm. That this is not simply a shell game, that the North Koreans do want to solve this problem. Now, one thing that all American administrations struggle with, and the Trump administration has and will, is the question of human rights in North Korea.
Right.
Now, the importance of human rights, I think, is obviously human rights themselves are important, and it's abhorrent. This is a brutal regime, but the significance of human rights is in what it tells us about the nature of the regime.
Right.
And so far, that regime hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. Look, if Kim had come to Singapore and said, I'm closing down all the gulags and I'm letting all the political prisoners free as evidence of my good faith that I want to change. You know, he talked about this as a new world, putting obstacles behind us. Now, that would be really significant. That mm-hmm. would be indicating that the nature of the regime is potentially, but seriously, potentially changing. We don't have any of that.
Right.
So then the question is, do you let human rights hang up a potential agreement over the nukes, right? So if you turn to CNN, all the coverage of the next day that I saw was about the human rights issue,
right?
Which is ironic because they never talked about the human rights issue before. Now, I'm all for the human rights issue and the fact that you've got to end this gulag regime, but Trump was there to negotiate something very, or begin the process right. of setting up a process of negotiating something very, very specific. Not the end of the gulag, not the change in the regime, which, of course, we are giving security guarantees to. Mm-hmm. Pompeo said it, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, right. and it was actually in the document, written, security guarantees.
Right.
That's not what we're negotiating. What we're negotiating is denuclearization, because that threatens us. So it's a very fine line to walk in terms of saying, okay, what are your hardcore state interests, the U.S. hardcore state interests, mm-hmm. and then what is that perfect world that you want to see?
Let's quickly go through winners and losers. Michael's under winners. I have Trump. I have Kim. Does China go into the category of winners?
Yeah, absolutely. I would actually rank it Kim, Trump, China, with Trump and China actually coming in sort of close to each other. So Kim, I think, is the clear winner. I mean, he's ended North Korea's international isolation. Mm-hmm. He's met the president of the United States, which his father and grandfather didn't get. Mm-hmm. He has so successfully developed his nuclear and nuclear weapons and ballistic missile capability that he can come to the table with some leverage. He stabilized the economy. And all of that was sort of summed up in this summit, where he looked young and at times a little bit sort of following what was going on, but he looked confident. So I think he was the big winner. I think Trump was for sure a short-term winner. And I think a short-term winner was he also looked confident. He looked like he actually was dominating. I don't mean overbearing, but he was dominating the conversation, sort of guiding.
He looked presidential.
He actually did. I think he looked presidential. He looked statesmanlike. He looked as he did when he meets other world leaders. So, you know, I think he comes across very well for that. And, of course, getting the North Korean leader to agree to complete denuclearization and starting a process, which other presidents also were not able to get. But in the longer run, the comments that he's made, again, about stopping exercises, about U.S. troops, all of these may be things that weaken the win that he came out from this weekend. And then the Chinese win, I think, big as well. They win because the U.S. has locked itself into another set of negotiations, which can be dragged on for a very long time. The Chinese win because they are now demanding a seat at those negotiations, and it'll be very hard to deny them that. They win because the president has announced his intention to stop exercises that they don't like. He's adopted some of the language. They win because they get to, as they're trying to do today, if you read the coverage, basically position themselves as the good faith arbiter. And, you know, in this moment of optimistic glee that everyone has that, my God, we may actually be getting towards the end of the beginning and we might actually be getting on a road that's going to get somewhere, then people also forget the quite frankly, unhelpful role that China's played in many years in supporting this regime and undercutting sanctions, watering down sanctions, closing its eye to cross-border trade, all sorts of things that have helped North Korea remain strong. Now everyone thinks, well, now we're all on the same page. We can all get on the table to negotiate denuclearization. Let's bring China in too. So I think Beijing, which was very, very worried about being cut out of a U.S., South Korean, North Korean deal, maybe even throw Japan in there, is now much more confident that it's going to be part of that process.
All right. So to those cynics who say that Xi Jinping somehow back-channeled to Donald Trump that if you want to avoid a trade war, find a peaceful solution in Korea, you would say what?
That Xi Jinping told Donald Trump that?
This is just Washington's full of conspiracy theories. This is one that somehow the Chinese government is back-channeled to the Trump administration, that if you want to avoid an all-out trade war, you will settle the Korean situation.
Well, I would have thought, actually, Bill, it would have been in the reverse, that Trump would have said to China, if you want to avoid a trade war, because I'm the one who's going to initiate it, you help me solve North Korea.
Okay.
Those are messages he's already sent. I mean, that's not new. He's said that to them. You know, he said, look, they're helping on North Korea. Why would I slap sanctions on them? That was last year. This year he slapped tariffs, not sanctions, but, you know, tariffs on them. So the Chinese were extremely nervous. To us, we don't think of that. You know, we think, oh, you know, they're, you know, I completely disagree with the people who say China holds the magic key to North Korea. And I heard some commentary that I cannot disagree with more, that North Korea went into this meeting because China told it to do so. That is a fundamental misunderstanding. I cannot stress it enough. That is a fundamental misunderstanding of how China and North Korea interact. And don't forget, Kim Jong-un refused to meet Xi Jinping for 6 years. He assassinated his uncle, who was China's man, China's conduit into North Korea. He assassinated his half-brother, who was under Chinese protection. This is not a guy who was simply following the Chinese tune. But that said, obviously China does have influence. We shouldn't deny that it has influence. Yet it has been very clear that it does not want to see North Korea disappear as a buffer state. So it's very confident now that with the U.S. giving security guarantees, with North Korea being essentially normalized. I mean, what we saw, Bill, both not only this past week, but over the past couple months, is the creeping normalization of North Korea. Right. I mean, you know, it's not official, but that is what's happened. And China wins from that because it means that North Korea is no longer considered a pariah state that should go away, but it's a player in the international arena, and certainly the Asian arena, and that's what China wants. So I think that, you know, the message probably from Trump was, don't scuttle this thing. And of course, he actually said that he thought that China might have caused the Pyongyang regime to take a much harder line a few weeks ago. And then, of course, Trump initially canceled the summit, and then boom, it was right back on.
Right.
You know, he left the door open and the North Koreans leapt at it. So again, indication that China is not calling all the shots, but it's important and it's influential.
Does Mr. Abe go in the category of winners? I noticed Mr. Abe was at the Rose Garden before the trip to Singapore. All things being hair-related, Donald Trump. Mr. Abe has fabulous hair, by the way, if you haven't noticed. He's a fabulous pompadour. But is he in the category of winners, or is he just a regional bystander?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the Japanese are very concerned about being regional bystanders. Mm-hmm. For the most part, the best that Japan can do is keep very close to the U.S. and conversely try to keep the U.S. close to Japan, right? Meaning don't cut a deal that undercuts Japanese interests. And that's why they're worried about this slowdown in the military exercises. I think they would be much, much more concerned about a drawdown of U.S. forces on the peninsula that might herald something that was a broader drawdown in the region. They don't have a lot of cards to play. I think that Abe said that Trump raised the issue of Japanese abductees with Kim, although the White House said that we're not going to be talking about human rights issues. So
right.
I haven't followed up. I don't know if that's the case or not. They certainly want America to be thinking about their interests. A lot of the media coverage is portraying Japan as the big loser. Look, if you denuclearize North Korea, Japan wins too. If you figure out some type of modus vivendi, vis-a-vis North Korea, Japan wins too. So I don't think Japan's a loser. Mm-hmm. Everything that conduces to stability on the in the region is good for Japan.
Right.
I think what the Japanese want to do is of course to be consulted, to be apprised, not to be left out of the loop, not to find out what happened in the New York Times, but to
right.
find out what happened from the administration. Of course, Secretary of State Pompeo is going, or I think he might already have been in Japan. He went there right away, Seoul and Tokyo, and then he's going to Beijing. So the Japanese, are always concerned about being left out of the loop, but it's ironic. So were the Chinese. Again, we as the Americans who are the pivotal players always, we don't have a good understanding of the emotional sense of a lot of the counterparts across the table. You would say, well, Japan and China are worried about being left out, and the answer is yes. So we don't think of it from those terms, but they always are, and I think that's where the question of the long-term undergirded stability of the U.S.-Japan alliance, and then you have to make sure that you are solicitous. You are keeping them in the loop. You're talking to them. You're asking them what they think about it.
Right.
And you're making them feel part of the process.
Let's now go through the loser side of it. We talked about human rights. Two things I'd like to talk about. One, the USS Pueblo, which I think technically, Michael, is the second oldest commissioned ship in the United States Navy. I think it is still recognized as commissioned, even though it's been under North Korean custody for the last, 50 years now?
Yes.
And then thirdly,
exactly.
Trump critics. Trump critics in this regard, Michael, you go from declaring Donald Trump a warmonger the past 4 or 5 months, saying that he is determined to lead us into a war on the Korean Peninsula, to now, he's now trying to do a peaceful solution. He has no idea what he's doing. Explain to me what the rational Trump criticism here. You can always criticize something no matter what they're doing. There is room to criticize here. So take us beyond just sort of the reflexive Trump derangement criticism to what is really a legitimate criticism of what he's doing here, how he's going about it, what he hopes to achieve.
Yeah, well, it's funny you raised the Pueblo. You're mm-hmm. talking to a fractional slice of the American public who even knows what happened in December of 1968. Well, it was right at Christmas in 1968. The USS Pueblo was a spy ship collecting electronic information off the coast of North Korea. The North Koreans claimed that it strayed into North Korean waters. I think it's pretty clear that it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And they attacked and swarmed the ship, took its crew captive for, I forget how long the crew was held captive, but for a period, and then they were released, and the ship was kept and became a, and to this day is a great, a great tourist site in Pyongyang. It's a symbol of the great victory over the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very quickly forgotten. It was a shameful period. It was a shameful episode and a shameful period. It was forgotten largely because we were in the height of the Vietnam War. In fact, we were just, months after the Tet Offensive, and everyone, thanks to Walter Cronkite, now felt that the Vietnam War was lost, even though As everyone who studied Vietnam knows, the Tet Offensive was a strategic catastrophe for the Viet Cong.
Right.
So people just wanted to brush it under the rug. So the Pueblo is still there. And great debate over, you know, should it have defended itself? Should it have gone down with all hands? What, you know, what should have happened to prevent the ship from being captured? I don't think it was raised in the talks. I certainly didn't hear it being raised in the talks. Those are the types of things, though, where you could see a surprise good faith gesture from Kim Jong-un that would let you think, well, either he's really wily, which, by the way, he is, and very smart and very successful, but also potentially changing in that, you know, I mean, if you wanted to pull a glasnost type thing, you know, Reagan going to Berlin, tear down this wall, and then, you know, the wall eventually starts coming down. You say, look, I'm giving you back the Pueblo. You know, there's things he could have done, so we're not there yet. In terms of the losers, look, I'm not a domestic politics guy. I stay away from that. I mean, obviously, we all have our own opinions and feelings. I think I'm more concerned as a policy analyst at the lack of a sober assessment and critique and analysis of U.S. policy.
Right.
Now, Trump, you know, admittedly, and he himself admits it, makes that difficult. That's not how he wants to play the game.
Right.
He wants to confound critics. He wants to keep people off balance. He wants strategic surprise so that he can shape negotiations. It will take a long time for us to step back and try to figure out, was he wildly successful in inducing a sense of uncertainty, if not fear, into the North Koreans that drove them to the table?
Right.
Or was he a willing dupe because the North Koreans are very confident that they can basically push the United States off the peninsula? We're just starting to reassess the Vietnam War because now we have contacts with the Vietnamese and they can tell us what they were thinking. We're nowhere near that with the North Koreans.
Right.
So the critics who simply look at one day he's bringing us to war and one day he's going to, you know, sell the farm,
right.
give the farm away. I think we shouldn't pay attention to them because they're not serious critics to me.
But there's a reflexive criticism inside Washington, Michael, and you know this very well because you work inside Washington as well. A foreign policy established inside Washington that's just reflexively anti-Trump. If Trump is doing this, if Trump is doing A, it must be, therefore, A must be bad because Trump is doing it. So the question is this. Rather than reflexively attack Donald Trump because he's Donald Trump, look at what he's doing in terms of the summit, look at what he's doing in North Korea, and just tell me from just a nonpartisan, just, you know, study perspective of what's going on here, what, if any, legitimate criticism there is to be had about this approach.
Sure. And I think that's what needs to be done. And by the way, just to get back one second to your point about the reflexive anti-Trumpism, Trump has taken the foreign policy establishment out of its comfort zone, obviously, very, very clearly.
Correct.
And so from that perspective, you know, if you had a different president who had worked this type of meeting in maybe a way that was done in which they understood the steps leading up to it, he'd be praised as a diplomatic genius.
Right.
So it's that Trump has, even regardless of their personal feelings for him, he does diplomacy differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think a legitimate criticism is that this was a very rushed summit. You very rarely see leaders meet on the fly, and this was pretty much on the fly.
Right.
You know, from the beginning to the end, it was a few months, and then it was on off. Trump, again, would disagree. He would say, look, you're about to say the same thing that has failed for 25 years, but again, you usually get things down to where all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed because no one wants there to be any ambiguity and uncertainty at the top level. Trump completely inverts that. You know, so is it a criticism? Well, you know, we don't operate the way he does. And I think it's way too simplistic to say, look, this is just a real estate deal. It goes beyond that. It's his view of interpersonal relations and human relations. And he said, I'm going to size him up. I'm going to know within a minute whether this is whether he's serious or not. He gets one shot at this, and I'm going to go in, and it's all going to be on instinct. That's not how diplomacy works. It's not how diplomats work, though great diplomatists often have a flair for that, right? They have that flair for the surprise and what is not thought about. I don't think Donald Trump will ever be considered, certainly by the mainstream media or the foreign policy establishment, as a great diplomatist. But I think there are criticisms that can be made about the speed with which this happened, just because, again, it there was a lot of uncertainty surrounding it. I would criticize, by the way, the use of the term provocative for our military exercises. Mm-hmm. They're training exercises. They're defensive exercises. They are not exercises designed to attack North Korea, or this is how we're going to attack North Korea. It's exercises as to how we're going to defend South Korea. They're not provocative.
Right.
They haven't been provocative for decades, and I think it sends the wrong signal to say that. Other than that, I think, you know, the proof is in the pudding about where we go forward. You could pull out things to criticize, certainly from what Bill Clinton did and George Bush and Barack Obama did. And you can pull out things to criticize Donald Trump. Should, for example, Secretary of Defense Mattis have been there? This is largely a defense issue, though it's Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, who was driving it. Right. Was there a conscious decision that we wanted to present a diplomatic face versus having a military face there? You know, those are things that would be good for them to express to us so we understand their thinking.
Mattis would probably say, this is diplomacy, not the military. I'll swim on my own lane.
So. Yeah, he may have, although when you're talking about, for example, the president saying we're not going to do provocative military exercises, I think that's why you want the Secretary of Defense to be in that room to say, wait. A, please don't use that term, and B, should we really be doing this? And if you do want to do it, Mr. President, let's nail it down exactly. Because today what you're seeing is the shovel brigade sort of going around saying, well, we're going to do training but not exercise. They're trying to figure out how do we massage this? How do we parse it? That's why I think you want him there, because you need that top level military input.
Finally, nits to pick. You mentioned the flag controversy. This was people objecting to the concept of the U.S. and North Korean flags being on equal display. What about the lunch, Michael? What about the concept of, instead of a long, fancy, ornate sit-down lunch, what if Donald Trump had taken him to McDonald's, which reportedly Kim Jong-un likes?
And which Trump said he would do.
Yes.
He said, I'm not going to give him a big lunch. I'm going to give him a hamburger.
Right. A little burger diplomacy. So maybe should Trump have done something a little more intimate like that instead of the big fancy thing? Or, again, is this just a nitpick?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a nitpick. It is fascinating. I mean, you know, if Trump had actually done that, which probably would have been impossible. I don't know. You know, they were on an island. You would have had to come off the island, get to a McDonald's, or it could have served a McDonald's.
Here is the first problem. We know that Kim traveled from North Korea to Singapore with his own toilet.
Yes.
Somebody with argument, we can make a foul comment on what kind of job that is, but arguably the worst job in the world, I think, being in charge of his of his discharges. So I think a man who is paranoid about his own stool samples being collected and tested, I don't think he's going to go into McDonald's and let somebody else make his hamburger.
Yeah, look, presidents usually don't do that. I mean, you know, with the tragic passing of Anthony Bourdain, that picture of him and Barack Obama having noodles, and I think it's Vietnam, if I remember, has been going viral. And, you know, that's the type of thing you can do. Probably with friends, you know, it's harder. I think it's great. I always think, by the way, that these huge state dinners that we throw are just wastes of time. And instead, if I were president, I'd be bringing foreign leaders to diners, to American diners.
I think Obama did take the Russian president, not Putin, to
Medvedev.
Medvedev. I think he took five guys for a burger.
I think he may have. I know he took Joe Biden to Five Guys.
Yes.
But of course, I don't get invited to those big state dinners. So I think we should be taking them to diners. You want to see, you know, it's the Khrushchev thing. Khrushchev has to get out into Iowa in 1959 to see how real Americans live. I take these guys to a diner on the outskirts of D.C. and say, this is how our people live, and now you're seeing America versus these, you know, this is not the court of Louis XIV at Versailles, and we always do those types of things. So the sit-down lunch, though, again, I was surprised. I think it was a good move, and I was surprised. What it showed was that they had a comfort level to be able to actually have that type of meal. It was not, obviously, a formal meal, lots of invitees. It was a working lunch, but again, I thought this might be how we used to do things with the Soviets, which is we glare across the table at each other for 45 minutes. It's in a cold room, and we get out of there. You know, this was certainly interesting. Do you want to give them the legitimacy of it? Well, look, you already gave them the legitimacy of the meeting. So this, I think, to sum up, is that this very much had Trump's personal stamp on it.
Right.
It really did. Now, a Barack Obama who was, you know, more aloof as an individual and yet very good in terms of these types of, like you said, taking Medvedev to Five Guys or sitting with Anthony Bourdain and slurping noodles, he also might have pulled off something that was homey and folksy and yet business oriented. I think a lot of people didn't expect Trump to do it. And the controversy over the flags, I think that's all it is. It's a controversy. Again, I would have preferred flags on opposite sides, but they clearly were trying to say that we're in a new era of working with North Korea. Bottom line, Bill, the proof's in the pudding.
All right, final questions here. The very Trump move would be to invite Kim Jong-un to Mar-a-Lago, to invite him to the United States, see the United States. Is that more likely than Trump going to Pyongyang? Is it more likely that Kim comes to the United States? But then the second question, Michael, is Nixon goes to China in 1972, and it yields dividends right away. You see American businesses getting into China very fast. Huge demand for agricultural products. I think Boeing sells 10 airplanes within a year. There is the creation of what is now today called the U.S.-China Business Council. You study North Korea. Tell me what the business approach is to North Korea in terms of United States investment, because that's the other way in which you change a society. You just give them good old-fashioned capitalistic sunshine. You start bringing in fast food and hotels. You saw the video Trump showed, Kim, which looked like a commercial for Miami Vice with speedboats and hotels in Miami, but he's trying to dazzle him with what the West has to offer. So explain how Western investment would get into North Korea and what the wisest investments in your estimate would be.
Yeah, so starting with the trip, Trump said he'd be willing to invite him to Washington. Mm-hmm. I think that most people would find a trip to Mar-a-Lago distasteful.
Okay.
I think a lot of people understood it, but found it mildly distasteful that Xi Jinping went. You know, he's a competitor and he runs a brutal authoritarian system, so why are you bringing him into your home?
Although we'll point out Brezhnev, I think, went to San Clemente at one point.
I may well have. I don't remember.
Anyway, so.
Well, you know, he when Nixon went to Russia, they did the cigarette speedboat together.
Right.
You know, so.
Now they didn't Khrushchev go to Disneyland? So.
He must have, right?
Anyway, okay.
Yeah. So look,
so you think Washington is the more dignified statesmanlike?
I think Washington's is better, although if we start to see that the regime is changing, and this gets to the second part of your question. Or your second question, then get him out to Iowa, get him down to Disneyland, get him to Mar-a-Lago or wherever you want. If you think that this is a regime that's changing, clearly we did not do that. We have not done that with a lot of countries where we didn't think that that was viable. Trump going to Pyongyang, I mean, that would be. But first of all, Kim coming to Washington would be mind blowing. Trump going to Pyongyang would be even more mind blowing.
It had to be something to sign if he went.
Yeah, and I just can't imagine that security wise we'd be comfortable. But then to get to your point on business,
Kim wants to announce to the world that North Korea is open for business. Right? He wants investment to come in. How does the United States invest?
Yeah, look, it's very difficult. First, you talk to the South Koreans who have been trying for decades, and it's going to be very controlled. It's going to be limited to these special economic areas and sort of like the Kaesong Industrial Complex. Yeah. It's not going to be we're opening up a Mercedes-Benz dealership in Pyongyang.
That was the Chinese experience initially when U.S. Companies went to China in the early 1970s. It's incredible amounts of bureaucracy and just Chinese blocking the path at all times to business.
Sure, but Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai wanted to change China.
Right.
In terms of bringing it into the world. We don't know yet how far Kim wants to bring North Korea into the world, because the fear is that you're going to have an East European type result where the people rise up. They see that there's a much better life, and they already know it's over the border in South Korea, which is why they control all of this with South Korea so much.
That's why it's fascinating you said that he actually was willing to put out photographs of themselves walking.
Yeah, I think that's been understudied as to what messages might come out from that. Clearly, there's a message of confidence, but there's also this, wow, look at this amazing city I'm walking through. And then, of course, that video I doubt is going to particularly change his mind unless we've all been misreading Kim Jong-un. That's what we're going to find out, Bill. Look. The Trump administration, let's give them some dangerous credit. And the dangerous credit is that they could have gone the tried and true path of slow, tortuous, methodical diplomacy with division chiefs and then deputy assistant secretaries and assistant secretaries and undersecretaries all the way up the chain. And that would have, and they are correct, and Trump is right, that would have eaten up their entire administration, either one or even two of them, right? So they've cut through that Gordian knot to say that, well, we're just going straight to the top and we'll see. We're going to shake the tree and see what comes out of it. So from that perspective, if, again, if Kim is serious about wanting to change his country, then you've sort of started that off by leapfrogging all of those intermediary steps. And American companies will be probably in this administration inserted right at the top level. But I can't imagine that happening in the North Korea of today or even tomorrow. It'd have to be the North Korea of tomorrow. It is too much of a risk. And what you could see is an agreement for American companies to provide goods into North Korea, but not to sell by themselves, not to open up stores, not to brand goods. But, you know, the North Koreans want more things. Everybody does. And American companies may have a conduit in that way.
Exit question. Donald Trump will be in office until at least January the 20th of 2021. Will there be a McDonald's flag flying over Pyongyang by that time?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
But we'll come back because I'll be wrong.
Michael Oslin, great talking to you.
Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to download and have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Michael Oslin and his Hoover's Fellowship to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Michael Oslin is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MichaelOslin. That's MichaelAuslin. I'll warn you, there are several Michael Oslins on Twitter. Look for the one that says the Old Northwesterner, which I assume means your college and not where you actually grew up.
No, it is. Chicago used to be known as the Old Northwest, that Northwest Territory.
Well done. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts and ideas from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org.